Hi, it's Dr. Mark Winnetong here. I'm the co-chair of the new Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Clinical Network, also the advisor to the Lowich Institute's Knowledge Translation Group and an adjunct professor at QUT. My mob's Cubby Cubby and South Sea Islander, and I'd like to acknowledge all of the traditional owners of the land that we're on and the elders past and present.
Mark, thank you very much for joining us. You were one of Australia's first Indigenous doctors, but medicine wasn't your first career. Can you tell us who and what inspired you to go back to university at age 32 and study medicine?
So look, there were a few issues that came together that allowed me to get back to uni and to get into medicine. One was that my mother was one of the first Aboriginal health workers in the Aboriginal health program here in Queensland. And I saw the work that she was doing. I was, you know, working in laboratories, been working in pathology for 11 years in the clinical laboratories here in Cairns. And so mum was one of the health workers who was sending in all of the pathology for us to look at. And I got a really strong sense of how bad the stats were, basically, around mortality and morbidity and everything from infectious diseases through to accidents and injuries. With those kind of things behind me, I thought, oh, what is the best way of influencing Aboriginal affairs, or how can I best make a contribution? And I thought of the law or medicine, and medicine, you know, was an obvious choice for me because I had so many years behind me in pathology and clinical laboratory areas. So that made it a lot easier for me. And basically it was, how can I contribute to improving the health of our mob?
Mark, when you graduated from Newcastle University, what did that mean to your family and the broader community?
Look, you know, was one of the first docs. There was probably three or four ahead of me, including some that were, you know, had, you know, Helen Miroy that had graduated long before me. But this was the start of bigger numbers for us graduating as health professionals. And so it was a fairly significant time. And I think that uni that I was at as well, University of Newcastle Medical School, had this good cred for supporting and graduating Indigenous medical students. So it was a significant thing for me. It was a significant thing for our community, I think, broadly speaking, not me individually, for us to be starting to get health professionals out there. With that, though, came quite a lot of responsibility as well, because, you know, especially the early doctors were seen as people who were going to solve the whole Aboriginal health issue, which put a bit of pressure on. But having said that, that's why I studied. So it was a good time, but there was a fair amount of pressure as well.
And Mark, speaking about pressure, can you tell us about the ABC interview that happened not long after you graduated?
Yeah, the ABC TV came and saw me when I was probably in about the third or fourth month of my internship. And their first question was, so how are you as an Aboriginal doctor going to solve the Aboriginal health crisis? And my response at the time, I think, was I'd be pretty happy if I didn't kill anybody this week as an intern. Yeah, there was a lot of pressure, I guess, to be the ones that made the difference, you know.
After graduating, Mark, what was your first job in medicine?
In the Hunter, I did my usual internship, residencies, etc., and got the full kind of suite of medical areas. But after that, I was able to work with my cousin in Central Australia, in Papunya, with World Vision on a program out there, a health program. And I'd have to say, look, it just opened my eyes to so much more than what was the kind of narrow clinical focus of medicine, to this whole sociocultural context and how to do medicine and how to care about people and what we should be caring about. So those kind of things I got taught by their mob in Papunya in Central Australia. And one of the biggest lessons I learned there was just to shut up and listen, really. I had the ability, you know, by working with an NGO to do things fairly flexibly. So able to kind of respond to what community thought were important as opposed to what I as a clinician thought was important. And that was a really key learning for me there, plus this interface between culture and best practice. And that in actual fact, you know, all of those things we talk about that seem to be add-ons like cultural safety, etc., they're not add-ons, they're just part of clinical best practice. And so learning those kinds of issues was really important for me out there. And I have to thank those communities and those community people for being so patient and generous with me.
Mark, you then went to Cairns and later Cape York. What was the highlight of your career there?
Look, I think in Cairns, where I was the SMO at Wuchopper and Health Service, which is a large urban Aboriginal medical service, it's very well run, very effective and efficient service. One of the things that happened to me there was that I'd actually turned up there and I was even contemplating whether I'd stay in medicine or not. And the senior medical officer there, Simon Bridge, who was the nicest guy, also is a mentor of mine, was a mentor of mine, he's passed on now. He kind of made it so that I couldn't get out of medicine, which is a fantastically good thing because, you know, I don't think we value as much as we could that kind of relationship of somebody supporting you, somebody having a bit of belief in you, and somebody actually pushing you in the right direction. And so Sam was a non-Indigenous doc, and he really taught me a lot and really helped and supported me a lot. But I guess the key message in that is it doesn't matter who you are in medicine, you know, if there's early graduates coming through, you know, that are Indigenous, the support that you give them can make a massive difference, and they can go on to make a massive difference as well. And then with Upuna Pimas and Cape York, being able to start there at the start before there any clinical service was really useful for me. And I mean that in the sense of, you know, usually we just dive in doctors and nurses and clinical models. And we had an opportunity there because when I first went to Upuna Pimas, there's only about 15 staff there and they were mostly community development advocacy staff. Building a clinical service then was a big issue, but had the opportunity to really look at the evidence, look at the local research, the broader research around what's happening in that's applicable to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health, to be able to say, hey, look, where actually are the intervention points? It's not just throwing out another clinic. It's like, how do we utilise the evidence base to actually do the interventions in the right places and the right time? So that was the learnings that I got there. And because we had quite a lot of local research that had been done in the Cape, and there's lots of emerging research around epigenetics, adverse childhood experiences, toxic stress, allostatic load, and a whole lot of things that linked in colonisation processes with current health outcomes and links it in biomedically, you know. So really, really important areas. So we were able to kind of design what we call a family-centred approach to primary healthcare there. It was based around those types of issues. So it was really around applying that evidence in a way that was culturally resonant and that, you know, fitted with all of our communities, ways and beings and things like that, but ensuring that we pulled everything together. And then also looking not just at the health kind of narrow focus, looking at what other, you know, who else needed to be involved in that, who did we need to articulate with it, cross portfolios and government departments. So everybody from, you know, Department of Children's Services right through to Rangers programs, education. So all of those areas kind of are very important around addressing both social determinants, cultural determinants, but really having that broader ecological kind of approach to primary healthcare was one of the things that we kind of tried to max out there a lot.
And Mark, you've recently been appointed as the inaugural chair of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Clinical Network for Queensland Health. What are your goals with the network?
There's kind of a few levels to this. The kind of higher order ones are structural reform. So what do we need to do with the health system at a systems level to make it work better for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and to get better health outcomes for them? And if you break that down, there's a couple of levels to that. One is making the system work for Aboriginal and Islander people is about all of those kind of issues around cultural safety, cultural security, etc. But the other side of this is not just getting people in, having services that are accessible, but actually having better outcomes, clinical outcomes, I mean. So how do we make sure that best practice and evidence-based practice is promulgated across the health system? Prior to this, I was mostly involved in primary healthcare, and because we have good champions and drivers and evidence bases for primary healthcare, was kind of easier. But this space now is looking at the whole health system, so tertiary care as well and hospital care, and that's really important areas. So the next level down is how we can articulate best with the other clinical networks. And I'd have to say so far, look, all of the clinical networks and the chairs have been so supportive and really looking for some guidance and ways that we can articulate what our programs of work are. So that's really important. The other part about that is that our group doesn't want to be seen as the kind of black hole for all things black. It's more about helping the other expert groups who are all experts in their own specialty areas, you know, renal, cardiovascular, et cetera, to be able to get the best out of what programs they're running in these spaces and give them the best advice and support that we possibly can, so that we articulate with them what they're already currently doing and we're not, you know, restarting things or duplicating issues. But those things are really important for this group, I think, is making sure we fit into the systems and we make sure we fit into the networks and find a way of us all working together to leverage off each other to get better health outcomes for Aboriginal and Islander people. And as I said, at the systems level, there's also, you know, some bigger programs on the horizon, such as the health equity policies and approaches, and those are the kind of bigger picture things that we want to make sure we articulate with as well at a system level, but right down to clinical level, you know, how best we ensure that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people get better health outcomes in Queensland and have input into that.
Mark, Queensland Health's Chief Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Officer Haleen Grogan has spoken about increasing the leadership capability in First Nations people. How do you see the clinical network progressing this?
Look, I think there's a number of ways we progress this, and I think they're really all important kind of structural leadership platforms, development platforms. So if we go right down to community level, we're looking at how communities and how community people have better input, but how well they're informed to have input into the health system and their knowledge and understanding of health system so that they can give best possible input that they possibly can. And that's really about helping to educate and take community people on a journey that want to be involved in this. And they're obviously our most important voice because they're the clients that tell us, you know, how well the system's working for them. So that's really important. But I think that kind of input from them and our ability to support and mentor community people who haven't had much experience in health systems or health policy before, I think that's really important as well, an important leadership development. The second run is around the network level, and that's particularly around emerging kind of clinicians and everyone from allied health and medicine, nursing, right through to Aboriginal health workers and others, and really helping them to understand their part in the health system and where they can be most influential, and particularly that they have a voice as well that we'll be listened to and heard, and then helping to once again mentor and support and build their expertise in health systems, health reforms, health policy, and identifying kind of system gaps and things like that. But also it's really linking them up with some of the current Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health leadership as well, so they're able to be mentored or just supported in what they know is the right way to do things. And of course, at the committee level, our committee may be a little bit different from the others. We're in the process of setting that up now, but we certainly want elders involved in our committee as well as emerging health professionals or youth, basically. Given that 50% of our population's youth, it seems stupid not to have somebody younger to provide that kind of input. And we have trainees and registrars, et cetera, that I'm sure can fit into that role. But once again, with them and with others, it's building and developing leadership skills in how to influence health systems and health system policy and work with our other fellow clinicians in ways that do provide leadership and helping people when they want to put their hand up and step up, supporting them, make sure they're able to sustain that kind of leadership.
Mark, you're talking there about emerging leaders, clinical leaders. Is there a piece of advice you would have for emerging First Nations clinical leaders?
There's plenty of advice, I think, and learnings. Some of that is just to understand that you have unique qualities and unique experiences that place you in a very interesting position so that you can provide this kind of leadership. So I guess it's not being backwards about being forwards, but understanding that you have skills and experiences that you can bring to the table that will make a difference to your mob's health. And to continue to do that, I think those learnings about diplomacy and humility are really big for our mob. So it's not about just being a big mouth or anything like that. This is about learning the system, understanding it, and then getting the best out of it. And also learning how to work with other people and other health professionals. So those issues, I think, are good ones to learn, and they're good ones to learn early on in your career. And the other thing is keeping a good eye open for when you see issues in your clinical practice, how that maps up to a systems level, and where the real change can be. So instead of us as clinicians just sitting around bitching about, you know, we can't do this and we can't do that, this is about, well, how could I influence the system to change that in a good way, in a positive way, you know, without just going to the media or whatever. So those kind of things are really important, I think, and that's about sustainable structural change. So I think learning those lessons is really important as well. And the third thing is, look, just taking care of yourself. This is hard. This is a hard gig. And, you know, we deal with a lot of deaths. And they're not just kind of clients. These are families and relations. And they're not always good deaths. There's harsh deaths. There's suicides. There's all sorts of things, you know, happening. And you're not immune to that. So just remember, you have to pace yourself and you have to take care of yourself and your own family at the same time.
Yeah, really important advice. Mark, if there was one thing you would like to see improve or change for the health and well-being of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the next 5 years, what would that be?
Look, I think there's a couple of, you know, it's pretty hard to answer that question. There's a couple of areas. Like, if I think about this in broadest terms for Aboriginal Islander health and Aboriginal Islander affairs, I think trust. Trust has always been lacking between us and the rest of the nation. And I mean that at a policy kind of level. But I think one of the things that should really drive and increase that level of trust in us being able to do things our way in the right way is the, you know, response to COVID. I can't think of a better example where we haven't had a single Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander death yet across Australia. We've had very few people that have been sick. And basically our communities and health leaders have led that approach. So I think trust is a big one, and I think we've got learnings now that we're able to say, hey, actually, you know, if we actually trusted these communities a bit more and listened to what they have to say, maybe we get better outcomes across the board in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander affairs. So that's a big one. Next level down, I think, for me, is around ensuring that we have this very broad evidence-based approach to Aboriginal mortality and morbidity and ill health, and that we're addressing and leveraging the right points and not just doing the whole blame the victim and stop drinking, smoking kind of approach, but really understand that broad ecological approach. And there's evidence around this. So how to address that and where to intervene, I think that's a biggie, and I'd love to see that addressed in the next 5 years.
Mark, can you tell us about the cultural determinants of health?
As we get more and more sophisticated about our understanding of health and the ways that people live and be and work, etc., within their ecology, I think all of us realise that there are a number of other issues that are much bigger than just medicine that are in play. And so for a fair while in public health, we talked about the social determinants of health, so housing, education, all those kind of things, all those structural things that make a difference to people's health outcomes. The cultural determinants of health include a whole lot of other issues around how we practice culture and what's important to us and how those things affect us. And we've just been involved in a big study called the MK study in Australia. So I'm a CEO on that with Ray Lovett's group at ANU. And that's looking at a whole lot of cultural determinants. So, you know, what's the value of being on country, of speaking language, of knowing who your mob is, those kind of things. And so we map them against people's life satisfaction, self-perceived health, and their well-being. And for all of those cultural determinants, we found a dose response. And we're talking about reasonably significant numbers here. So basically, in the past, what people and government policy has called, you know, outdated, like, tourism kind of culture and dysfunctional culture, what we're saying is, no, culture is central. It's vitally important, and it makes a difference therapeutically to us and our children. So the cultural determinants are really, really important. The hard part, of course, is how you articulate cultural determinants with health. So at a policy level, that's not that hard. You can just talk about it, talk about the importance of culture when people come in to see you in your clinics, etc. That's what's of central importance to them in their lives or how they live. And sometimes, you know, you have to understand this culture stuff is intuitive for most of our mobs. So it's not like we always come in talking about it. It's just intuitive stuff. So it's really important that the rest of the health system understands that, because we may not talk about it that specifically. But on the other side of things, there's a whole lot of things that happen at community level. So our cultural approaches to death and dying and smoking ceremonies and the use of traditional healers, the use of traditional medicines, all those things I see as part of the cultural determinants of health as well. They can have a major impact, and they're kind of the other side of the picture from the Western approaches to health. So how can we as clinicians and health services ensure that we support these cultural issues as opposed to just saying, no, there's only one way to do this, and that's Western medicine way. So issues like, you know, the data we found on being on country and its usefulness therapeutically is great evidence, but it means that when the men's group say, it'd be great for us to be able to go and camp on our country, you know, for a few days, that's not just the boys going camping, that's a therapeutic approach. And we have good evidence that it makes a difference to people's well-being. And I think these kind of cultural issues are they're the kind of things that are protective as well as being therapeutic. Really important issues. And the more that we find out about how important they are to us, the more that we'll be able to utilise and leverage them in a health perspective as well for better outcomes for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
Mark, the theme for this year's NAIDOC Week is Heal Country. What does that mean to you, and what do you hope listeners take away?
There's probably two answers to that. One is a big metaphysical cultural kind of answer, and the other is more what I was just talking about. How do we, as clinicians, what does that mean for us? You know, how does that human relationship to our country, how does that affect our health? And they're important things to understand. And so from a clinical and a kind of health service perspective, what is the relationship between health and our people and land and healing our country? At a higher level, though, you know, we're talking about everything from climate change through to environmental issues, you know. And as well as that, like kind of from our context, it's about spirituality as well as culture and all of those things that we do and practice, like our dances. I just came back from the Laura Dance Festival. You know, our relationship with the Australian continent is a very, very long kind of symbiotic relationship. And from our perspective, healing country heals us, and healing us heals country. So those kind of things, like the dances that are performed, they're not just for show, for tourism. They're real dances about country and song lines and where people and where things came from, you know, in a kind of a spiritual sense, as a response from country that is healing. And once again, when we see everything that's happening, you know, from out of control fires and climate change and things like that, to the way that we were taught over 90,000 years to take care of country and not defile it and not, you know, misuse it or mismanage it, that becomes really a strong, important thing, I think, in international affairs currently. This is, you know, it's not just about, you know, whether we're corporately using land and things like that. This is kind of about how we're able to practice our culture on land as well, and the things that we do that help our country to be optimised and you know, healed. You can say it that way. So from way back in the day when there was 30 or 40 maybe people in a small tribal group that were coexisting with land and taking care of it, to suddenly, you know, 10,000 head of cattle and sheep on that same piece of land, pretty much stuffing up the whole ecology and environment. And then with that, our way of life, you kind of start to get a sense of this. The other thing that's worth looking at here is, I'm not sure most people will follow, but SEN, you know, Marcha's SEN cultural capability approach, is kind of that stuff around from an economist's or sociology economist's perspective on what makes people happy, really, is being able to apply your capabilities in life. When you look at it that way, it's kind of a very different application of capabilities, because we'd say we have cultural capabilities, and that Alex Brown's PhD in Central Australia looked at, is another Aboriginal doctor, looked at Aboriginal men and their relationship to depression and heart disease and country. And, you know, those old men said to him, you know, what, we can't practice what we've got 90,000 years of genes telling us to do anymore. We can't take care of the country. There is none left that we can access, you know. It's all overrun by properties and all sorts of other things happening there. So what are we supposed to do now? So we can say to people, well, meaningful employment is going and painting rocks white in a remote community, and that's not going to be very meaningful for most people, but particularly for our mob. So it's really important to understand that relationship to country in a long, long-term process, and then how much that means or meant and means to our communities and our community's wellness, because these are the kind of links between colonisation and current health outcomes. And it's just important to understand that. So this is not about blame or anything like that. This is just about pointing out the facts. And this also feeds into physiological, biological and biomedical kind of frameworks as well, around, you know, how all of those losses affect, you know, stress levels and toxic stress and low-grade inflammation, and result, you know, potentially in excess morbidity in chronic diseases, etc.
Mark, thank you very much for finding the time to talk with us during NAIDOC Week. It's been wonderful.
No problems at all. Thank you very much.